Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Phoenix. Please welcome a man who has all his own hair. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Hello. Hello, the Phoenix. Lovely to be back. You're much better than last week's audience. Oh, it's good to be back on stage. Welcome to Richard Herring's Low Stress Training Podcast. It's, I can see a few potheads out there know what I'm talking about. Change of direction on the podcast this week. Me and my guest will be discussing the technique used to train cannabis plants into the desired shape to maximise light usage and yields. Low stress training. I hardly need to tell you that's what that is. I love it. Oh, I sure love cannabis. Cannabising around. That's what I like. But I was talking to Michael Fabricant this week, and he says he calls it whatever Boris Johnson tells him to call it. So he refuses to call it Rahalastapa. Hooray! Lovely to see you all. Thank you for coming out. Not much has been going on since last week. It's been very quiet for me since the last show. I went and sat over there. My son, Ernest Herring, came back from his grandparents the other day and said that he wanted a real magic wand. He wanted a magic wand. He said, I want a real magic wand so I can make people fly and then I can fly. And as a dad, you kind of want to do everything you can for your son. So I said we would get him one of those. So if anyone knows where to get a real magic wand that he can actually... It reminds you when you're 4 years old, though. It's sort of that powerlessness of being four. It would be really cool just to be able to... I don't think in his hands, I think it would be a dangerous thing. But as a good dad, I want to try and do that for him. So if anyone can help me with that, I know a lot of wizards listen to her. He thinks he's a wizard. And maybe he is. Don't judge.
Diagon Alley.
Diagon Alley, yeah, it could be. Do you think, I'd never realised this until someone said it the other day. Do you think Diagon Alley is called that because it sounds like diagonally? Yeah. I didn't realise that until the other day. It took me 20 years to get that joke. Now I cannot enjoy it anymore because J.K. Rowling is transphobic. I'm very woke. I would have enjoyed that 10 years ago, but now, knowing the stuff that's come, that the inventor of that joke, diagonally. I mean, it's not really a pun because, was it diagonal, diagonally? Oh, it is a pun. And I saw the news this week that a robot Hoover had escaped from a travelodge in Cambridge. It's begun. But you know, I thought it was. I stayed in a travel lodge in Cambridge where there was someone else's bogey on the shower curtain, and I thought that explains it, because you know those hoovers can't get up, they can't go vertically. They're making robots do it all, but it was a different one apparently. So, you know, people try to escape those travelers. Never stay in a travel lodge. That's what I'm saying to you. Unless they advertise, unless they're this week's sponsors. We might have to go back. Because the thing is, like, they could sponsor us in 10 years' time, and I could have forgotten that we said that. In fact, I think the last time Mark Watson was on the... Oh, giving away who the guest is. was on the podcast, I think we talked about Bill Hicks and advertising, and when the adverts first started going in, someone listened to that, and halfway through us that conversation, the conversation broke off for an advert to come on. I'm going, yeah, I'd never do adverts. Go and stay at a travel lodge. They have robots there. You can fuck them if you want. That's why they escape. Get it back in there. I'm going to be the Jeffrey Epstein of the robot world. 10 years' time, it'll come out. Because it was fine. In this day and age, it's fine. It's robots are just hoovers. But in 20 years' time, robots went, how can he fuck the robots? Can't judge people by the stand, can you? You're saying you can't judge Jeffrey Epstein? Make me sick. I'm very woke. I think what Jeffrey Epstein did was wrong. He's almost as bad as J.K. Rowling. Okay, my guest this week. I mean, we all know what he's best known for. Improvisation, my dear Mark Watson. But we can't do the same thing every time. So let's just pretend that he's best known for his appearance on Odd One In. Odd One Out, Odd One In. It's Mark Watson, ladies and gentlemen. Here he comes. The odd one in. I kind of got up on the stool okay again. Nearly.
I can't immediately think what Odd One In was.
Well, Odd One In, I wondered whether you were. It's not Odd One Out. You think, when it starts, go Odd One, and you're thinking out. So oh, yeah. You're thinking it's going to go no.
Right, this is a clever title.
It's Odd One In. It was hosted by Bradley Walsh from The Chase.
I now remember, yeah. Dear me. Peter Andre was my fellow guest.
That's, yeah, I remember. Well, I looked through the list of people, and I wondered which one you were on with. There was a few names in there. Peter Andre.
It was
the cream of the crop.
It was Andre, yeah. I got, at the time, a selfie with him, but it's on an old phone, which will probably never be seen again. But... to be absolutely fair, Peter Andre probably won't be seen again. So I don't know. Yes, it was some sort of... I think an ITV... It was one of these things that you sometimes get where you wouldn't watch it, but it might be on if you were, like, in a hospital. Quite a lot of the TV shows I've done, you would only really see it if you were what you'd call waiting for something.
Okay. There's a very thin line, though, between those shows that kind of disappear and, The Chase... Could easily have been a 15 episodes and then disappeared, but it's gone on for 10, 12 years. It's very good, though, The Chase. I can't remember Odd One. Do you remember what the premise of Odd One is?
I can't even...
Was it you had to put the Odd One in something?
I think it would have been one of these things.
Was everything odd, apart from one thing that wasn't odd, and you had to take the thing that wasn't odd out, the one thing that wasn't...
This is why
like
Bradley gets
things.
These gigs, mate. He explained it much more succinctly than this. I can't remember, but I think it was you had to find an odd thing and put it in a thing that it shouldn't be in, basically. So maybe find a trifle, put it in a bank account. I can't remember a fucking thing about it, but I do remember, and until you said Odd One In, I would have... It makes me question how many other things I've done like this where... But you're right, though. It is, if you'd been on a pilot of The Chase or something, you'd have probably thought, well, I'll never think about that again. And then I've been involved in a handful of things which seemed quite shit and then went on to be... like Celebrity Juice, I remember being... I wasn't on it, but I was involved in a run-through of the idea. And I did sort of think, this is one of the worst things I've ever been involved in. And... I went home thinking, I doubt they'll book me for that. But on the plus side, Celebrity Juice will never be a thing. And I've also been involved in things where I thought, well, that was great, actually. Looking forward to the famous one being the improvisation show, of course. But I so basically, yeah, you. This is the trouble, isn't it?
Yeah.
With you don't like to turn things down because it might turn out it's really good, but still the odd one in thing is peculiar because I will have done half a dozen things like that which I'll never remember again. Like if I was at gunpoint and I could only be reprieved by listing all the TV shows I've been on, I still wouldn't have got that. And but you'd think, and it sounds like I'm. It's obviously not a boast, but it is an odd thing. When I was at school, if someone had said to me, do you reckon you'll ever be on a TV show with Peter Andre? And forget it. Of course not, no. So in a way, that shows I've had quite a good, varied career, but it doesn't feel that way.
Well, that's sort of your audio book that's Eight Deaths, which is and Life After Them, which is on Audible. Sort of is a little bit about that, isn't it? About the choices in life that come up and the things that, and certainly the shows that you've created, one has created. I mean, a lot of this book resonates very strongly with me as...
That's good.
Well, because we've had very similar terrible careers.
We're both people that do absolute loads of stuff, and some of it is fine, and some of it you look back and think, oh dear.
Well, we've both been going for, you know, I've been going a little bit longer than you, but we've both worked the whole time, and we've both tried to put together loads of shows for executives that haven't come off. My favourite one from the book is you taking something to a channel and them telling you that it didn't fit the voice of the channel and then recommending one of your shows as the voice of the channel that he didn't realise you'd written.
Yes, it was BBC Four, this, and it was... they were saying, I don't think this is quite right. It doesn't seem like the... it's a very specific voice, BBC Four, the guy was saying. The guy had sort of a hairy... You know when someone's got their shirt, like, it's not done up enough. And, yeah, the sort of... He looked like someone that you might have got presenting Top of the Pops in the 90s. And but he was the commissioner. I had to impress him. And, yeah, he said, I don't think that you quite know the flavour of the channel. A good thing to watch would be a thing called A Child's Christmases in Wales. That was one of our big... And I had to politely say, I wrote that. And... which I had. It was only a one-off, so it passed him by a bit, but that was for his channel, and that was a moment where I thought, and about 5 minutes after that, there was a knock on the door, and his assistant came in and said, your next thing is... But I don't... That wasn't true, I don't think. That's why these guys get the big bucks, because I don't know how he made that happen, but he must have had some sort of panic. But yeah, I've been... And it's been the same for you, Richard. I've been... Even apart from the things that I've tried and failed to pitch, I've been sort of attached to so many TV projects which didn't happen, and some of them you look back on and think that was never gonna. But I saw this email recently, I'd forgotten about this as well, but about 7 or 8 years ago for Channel 5, to be fair, Channel 5, but still it does exist. These people are worthy of love like anyone. A production company said, we've pitched this to Channel 5, is it all right to put your name on it? And it was called Mark Watson's Big Clean. And, right? Already, it writes itself. There's a huge audience for this. And the premise was, you know these people that go up just the top of high-rise buildings and clean the windows on those gantries? I would do that. And over six episodes, the whole series was there. Over six episodes... I would clean six different really tall buildings and get an insight into what it's like to be one of those guys. Anyway, as I say, 8 years ago, and we've not heard anything for a while. So, and at that time, I was doing quite a bit of telly, and I suppose I was... But even... Like, even now, if you attach Acaster to that, I'm not sure... I don't think it's... But and it's funny, like, again, you've had it, Richard, where you read the pitch and you think... Well, yeah, I suppose I'll probably... I don't know, I'd be very uncomfortable with the... But I'd probably do it, but who the fuck wants to watch... Like, no one wants to watch that shit. But you think, well, these guys are in TV. They know what they're doing, so fair enough. And then when you look back on it from 8 years' vantage point, you think, they must have been absolutely desperate. There was a whole production company who, a month of their development time, was just, like, writing up this treatment and photoshopping in pictures of me halfway up the Eiffel Tower. It's like... Who would watch that? Nobody would watch it. Not even a pilot. Six episodes.
It's just about they'd settled on you. I wonder if they had got like ten different celebrities in and photoshopped different celebrities, they'd go, "This has to be Mark." First of all, this has to be Mark Watson, right? That's the deal killer. It has to be him cleaning buildings, because that's otherwise, you know, what's the hook?
You can't help wondering. There'll be. I mean, we joke about it, but right now, if someone is writing up, putting the finishing touches to Richard Osman's Big Clean, and although one of the guys that tall, there's no challenge in it. So he just like just gets a tea towel and does it standing up. But yeah, like again, 10 years ago, I was quite not exactly bitter, but I used to take it really personally. Now these things come and go, and you just think, well, yeah, that was probably not a very good idea. And also you accept that most things that do well on TV probably were destined to. Like, even Celebrity Juice, I could understand why it was successful. And most things that weren't going to have a chance just didn't anyway. So it's less to do with you.
Well, it is, but I think it sort of really points up the... There's a lot of chances, I think, on both, in front of the camera and behind the camera in TV. And that, I mean, that story about an executive pitching, you know, saying you're no good and this is good, but you wrote it, is just... You would think if that turned up in a script, you'd go, that's too on the nose.
But yeah, and I think he'd commissioned the one that I wrote as well. I don't think he was a newcomer.
Everyone's sort of played, but like we were writing one of our radio shows in one of these production companies, and it sort of just struck me, you know, there was someone working on another show, on some desks across from us as we were writing our show, and they were trying to come up with guests for the. Whatever the show was, and the way they were doing that was flicking through the Radio Times and just saying every name they saw in the Radio Times, and you go, "Oh, that's how they booked." So they would just read out the name; they wouldn't necessarily even know who it was. Go, "What about this? Oh no, I don't know who that is." So that's the booker of a TV show.
Yeah, it tends to be whoever it already is on. Let's have them again, which is why it's difficult if you're on the. And this is sort of partly what the audiobook is about. If you get on the wrong side of that, it feels very difficult to get back on the right side of it. Whereas if you are somebody like, I don't know, Richard Iwadi, or if you basically, the thing with TV is if you're on it, you'll keep being on it. But if you can't get on it, then you will continue to not get on it. And if you are on one side of that and then fall the wrong side of the line, you feel as if you've committed some terrible, like you'll never get back, you know. And that sort of is true. Once you've lapsed into the point where you can't get on TV as much anymore, it is very hard to reverse that. But it's whether it matters as much, because a lot of these TV shows don't make any difference to your life anyway. You feel as if you ought to be doing it, that's all. And it's measure of your success in life.
It does feel, but I think that's the book is a sort of, is your sort of journey through realising what's more important in life. And maybe if you had crossed that line and been one of the guys on the other side, you wouldn't have had that realization. But you know, that's why, again, you know, that similarly for me, I can remember, you know, we'd been on TV, we were doing quite well, and I remember going to a party, and I think it was like the League of Gentlemen guys, who were all lovely guys, but I just remember feeling not. It might have been the Space guys as well. They were all up and coming and about to break.
Yeah,
and I felt, you know, I was always very shy in social situations anyway, and would walk and leave anyway. But I felt like, oh, I'm not in. You know, I can see these guys are going to be the ones who go ahead and I'm going to disappear. And I was exactly... I'm very good at predicting things. Yeah. Very good. I should go into predicting. That's what I should do. Because I always... But it's that, you know, it's that moment of realising, and it feels important, but actually, I think, again, for both of it, I mean...
It's very easy to... And I'm the same. There's been various moments. Acast is only one example where I've seen... Nish was a clear example where... And actually, Ramesh Ranganathan. In fact, the more I think about it, there's been a handful of times in my career where people that were, at the time, lower status than me, where I went to watch their show, championed them for a bit, and then thought, actually, this guy's fine. And, not just fine, but will inevitably take my place. And it's a weird, again, it's an ego thing. If you can remember having a relationship with someone where you go, oh, you're very good, keep at it, I reckon you're... And then 5 years later, you're sort of... hoping you might get to work with them. Like that is a thing you've got to deal with. But if you stay around long enough, like we both have, you've just got to accept there's always going to be people that just do that.
And I think it's a career path that isn't like most jobs, in which case you were doing quite well and you'd move up the ladder. It's just, you know, it does, that can happen, but also it's brutal, you know. I think a lot of the time they'll take someone young, and I think that's why it's difficult to cope with, and it's probably why we both found it difficult to cope with, is that you get to a certain point and then suddenly they pull the rug out, and then you have to there's no one there going, this is how you get through this, you know, you don't have to worry. You know, you'll find your own way through, as you have done, and I think I did as well, but there's no one there to help you with it.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It's a brutal process.
With stuff like, with music, I often look at people like, it's a bit different because some of these people made enormous money when they were, but sometimes you hear about it, people like David Gray, who did Babylon and stuff like that, or the Darkness, or there were all these, you know, music is even worse than comedy for it, where someone has their moment and then they're gone. But then sometimes you think about them 15 years on and think, I wonder what he's doing. And when you Google them, the answer is they're still just doing it and they're fine.
Yeah.
They're just not that famous anymore. But the people that like them still like them and they're still pretty happy. It's just that it's really easy to think, oh, that guy must have had some sort of massive crash and burn situation because you don't... But it's just that music, even more than comedy, is like, it's the same thing, basically. You get a spotlight shone on you for a few years, but then, especially most comedians are doing better work 20 years in than they were 5 years in, because you just get better at doing stuff.
Yeah.
But it's the same with novels, comedy, most art forms, basically. You continue to grow as a performer or artist far beyond the point where the industry's still interested in you. So that was the same with a lot of things. I was still a massive REM fan years after people were saying, oh, they're still going. You know, yeah, they're still going. They've created a beautiful 25-year body of work. But people are like, yeah, but it's a long time since Shining Happy People. And, but like, so basically, at some point, you have to divorce your idea of what you're making from the expectation that you are still famous for doing it, I think. But again, it's ego, isn't it?
It's ego, but it's about not, as you discuss in this audiobook, it's about not competing with other... If you compete with other people... And again, this is something I've talked about a bit, but when I went to see Seinfeld, I got invited to watch... I got invited along because the people making my DVD were promoting the tour.
Like Joe, when he did live shows in London?
Yeah, so I got to go... I got to sit really at the front and then go to the after show, and I don't really... That never happens. But it was like every comedian in the country was there, more or less, all the big comedians. But they're all kind of looking over each other's shoulder at who else was there.
Yeah.
And arguing about who had the best. I thought I had the best seats because I was sitting like 5 feet away from Jerry Seinfeld. They were all going, I was in this box and this box was better than this. You know, they were all competing.
And
Ricky Gervais was the only person who I'd say was happy amongst all that.
As usual. Sure.
But right, you know,
that's a rule of thumb for life.
He was at the top of that pecking order. But everyone else seemed just sad. And I was thinking, this is really exciting. This is loads of fun.
Yeah.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
If you just compete with yourself, or even if you just are happy with what you're doing, try and do your best.
Yeah, I think
you can
find fuel for disappointment forever if you look at what other people are doing. Because I can't remember who it was, but someone said to me quite early on, the thing is, other people are allowed to be talented. And it's true. Like you have your moment where you feel like it's now about me. But it's very difficult to dominate an art form so much that you can actually choke any other talent from coming through. But also you have to ask yourself, and I'm saying this, I'm not very good at it, but you should ask yourself, what do I want this for? Am I just, like, I often see, I've been on Have I Got News For You, I think 3 times, but not for years. And on each of those occasions, I think I did a good job. Like, I didn't do anything wrong. But at a certain point, they just sort of lost interest in booking me. And these days, I'll see the lineups, and like Josh Whitaker will be on, or who I like, by the way, but just like comparable people to me, but a bit younger. And I'll think, ah, what happened? Or Would I Lie To You is another example. I had one of those. It's great. I loved it. I'd love to be on that, but I'd probably never get on again. And again, similar comedians to me are. But then you sort of think, I don't even watch Have I Got News For You. What? I don't really know anyone who watches that.
I'll tell you what's weird about
it. Like, well, why am I worrying about this?
If you do watch Have I Got News For You after a while, which I did, I haven't watched it for about five, six, 7 years. And it's really weird because they're so much older in that time that it's really free. Because in your brain, it's still 2010.
Yeah,
and then you see them now, and quite reasonably, they've got older. But
it's a bit like Only Fools and Horses, where Del Boy was like, come on, Wadders. And you're like, mate, you should just be drawing a pension now.
For a long time.
What I Like To You is a bit different, because I do like that show a lot. But even that, I don't really watch it. It's easy to set these things up and think, oh, I can't get this, I can't get that anymore. But then... why are you really... it's not that... I mean, of course, it's useful to do TV shows for your career and stuff like that, but it's very easy to look at what other people are up to. And I've seen people that announce... Netflix announced that some bloke is doing a series, some younger comedian is doing a series where they're like, go around and infiltrate drug cartels in Costa Rica or something. And immediately, again, your instinct is like, I could have done that. And then... after 5 minutes, you think, yeah, but the thing is, I would have died. I think you have to try and switch off the instinct that it's like whatever anyone else is doing, you think, damn it, that could have been me. Because a lot of the time, it either couldn't have been or shouldn't have been, or it doesn't matter.
But it's always interesting, like, having this book read to me by you, because I don't think it doesn't exist as a book.
No, it's purely an audiobook.
My perspective of you would always be that you were really doing very well, that you were very creative, you were creating these 24-hour shows, these amazing Edinburgh shows, and you were also doing what you wanted. Having talked to you, I knew that, you know, sometimes you would do something more commercial in order to fund your other projects. But it seemed to me how you would completely sort of... we shared a tour manager, so that was the only reason I knew...
Because
he was touring with both of us, and we were both slightly disappointed about how things were going on our tour.
Maybe he was the problem.
Yeah, I think it probably was.
Maybe it's Giles.
That's why it really resonates. Nearly everything is happening. I think I was feeling better than you, because I was every year I was progressing, but very, very slowly.
Yeah.
But it's you know, it's sort of weird to me that you would A, care about most of the things that you're talking about, but also it felt like your career was going really, really well from my perspective.
It's because I was part of a collective of... well, actually, collective is not the right word. That implies that we were all sort of on the same team. But, I was contemporary of people like, I suppose, Russell Howard, Jason Manford, and even Russell Kane. And, like, I came up alongside various comedian Rod Gilbert, I suppose, again. So, like, and even Greg Davis, actually, who was... so, and I all of those people have become sort of more house... I suppose there was and even McIntyre, actually. I mentioned this in the audiobook. Yeah. I did loads of like club gigs with Michael McIntyre, and like, I talked in the audiobook about this particular drive home where we'd play, both of us had played, and I always thought and I still do think that he's really good, by the way. This is not, but we played in front of about 40 people, and both of us had a great gig, and we were talking on the way home about what we're going to do, because these gigs are quite depressing. We both think we're maybe better than this. And he said something like, I know I'm going to be... In a few years, I'll be beyond this. I'm going to be big. And he wasn't really saying it boastfully. He was just one of these people that, you know, visualises a thing and is totally... And then, like, 5 years after that, he was the biggest comedian in the country. Russell was huge. Manford. I just basically, if I'd come through in more normal circumstances, I think I'd be very satisfied. And in a lot of ways I am, because a lot of the projects I've done and continue to do are things which those people aren't interested in, and they're not writing novels. And so it's not fair to compare myself to. It's just there was a window early in my career where I was encouraged to see myself as a sort of future millionaire, touring the world type comedian, and all those other people are.
Yeah.
And so you, it's very, very difficult to shrug off the feeling that you did something massively wrong.
Yeah, but I don't use it. But the thing is, there's a little bit of luck in all of this. So I think doing this podcast and meeting so many comedians and talking to so many comedians, I realise how most... I mean, I choose people I like and who people I think are good and who work hard. But they're... So everyone's so talented, and some of them are known and some of them aren't known, and the people so put so much work into it, and just sometimes someone, you know, there's an element of luck. There's only so many places. There might have been 9 places at that table, and you were, you know, you turned up and you were number 10, you know what I mean?
It's my fault for being late.
Yeah, you were late.
Yeah.
So, but I also
should have set the alarm.
I also think it's not, that's, you know, I look at it and I think, I look at TV. I, when I was young, I just wanted to be on TV and do sketch shows and do sitcoms or whatever, but TV doesn't even really do those things anymore. So
that's also true.
There's sort of nothing that really interests me. Sometimes I'll do. I like Taskmaster. Now I've done that, and
yeah,
and
we all like shows that have booked us.
I would like.
Yeah,
I would like to do Would I Lie to You. I think Would I Lie to You is about the only show that I think I'd like to do that. That's a fun show, but there's my ambitions about sort of doing those. I mean, the shows you talk about, funnily, like the learner driver show you ended up on. I mean, I've done shows like that.
Yeah,
I did. I rode with Toby Young, and as we discussed last week. But
most of that stuff isn't worth pursuing. No. You just feel like you ought to be.
But also, it's kind of a waste of your time because you're writing novels and coming up with great shows. No, even if you'd stuck it out and done that whole driving school show, I know you walked off it. No one would remember it, and no one would care about it. I don't remember it, so
no,
it's
most
sort
people
of a,
don't.
It's
care.
Like a waste of 3 months of your life, isn't it?
It is, really. And also, if you think about the things that people are doing with their fame, I suppose. I mean, like, and this none of this is to do down anyone because all these people are people I like, but like, I don't know, Jason Manford does, you know, like records music albums with like big bands and stuff. I don't have any ambition to do that. Rod has mostly used his fame and success to like just not work if he can help it. Again, not a criticism. The guy's brilliant. I love him. Russell, I suppose I do feel like, yeah, I wouldn't mind doing 150 seat world tours. But yeah, I wouldn't be writing. I could only be doing the set of things that I am doing because I'm me, basically. Yeah. So, and if you dig down into that, that's what it is for most people, really. There's no point in looking at what other people are doing because they're not doing the stuff that you would. Like, I've written, whatever it is, 7 novels, and I probably wouldn't have done that if I'd been spoon-fed loads of success as a live comic. So if you step
But you know,
away
the other thing is, like, it's pretty... Most comics look at that and go, I would like to write 7 novels. I don't particularly... You know, people wouldn't necessarily particularly care. I mean, it's nicer if they turn out to be the Harry Potter 7 novels. That would be nicer. But...
Yeah,
no, it's
if you're going to write 7 novels, those will probably be the ones to write. Yeah,
probably not now. I mean, because A, they've written, and B, you know.
I'm not taking a position on it. But, but you're right, and also like, I feel like, and again, the 24-hour shows and a lot of the weirdest projects I've done, which I'm proudest of, probably could only have come from a place of being a little bit of an underdog figure, because if someone like. If someone with a huge fan base like Russell did that, you'd get, to be absolutely fair, too many mad people. Like I can only do the things I do because I'm in the niche I am, really. But it's just, I think it's I think probably you can always, I always measure myself against the absolute biggest names in the world.
Yeah.
I think with Russell, I think about it quite a lot because both of us from Bristol, similar ages, similar trajectories, and he became hugely successful. But, you know, he did a very many series on Mock the Week, and I didn't have the temperament. I wouldn't have done that. And then he did Russell Howard's Good News, where he's doing like topical stuff every week, and I couldn't have done that either. So, really, you're not comparable. He went off and did the stuff he was meant to do, which was... that, like, being on telly a lot, and I went off and did things like writing novels and doing weird comedy projects that exactly 200 people care about, but they're really into it. So if you take some distance from it, the thing you end up doing, and also get to, I tour the country as a stand-up, which is actually all I wanted when I started. Yeah. I'm very lucky to be doing this. It's just very hard not to measure yourself against the absolute biggest, most famous people in your field and wonder why that isn't you. But I don't know.
I mean, the book feels like you've sort of... I mean, because it isn't like... It's not that here's my amazing journey through this and now I'm sorted. You're not saying that at all, but it seems like you've gone on a journey and sort of realised this that you're sort of saying now, but you're still there's still an element of you. Because I've been through that journey and I'm just thinking, I wouldn't be able to have done... 90% of the stuff I do, I wouldn't be able to do, and I like all the things I do. And so if my career had gone as I'd hoped it would go, I wouldn't have a podcast in which I interviewed comedians in a cellar underneath the pub.
If you'd had the career you wanted, both of us wouldn't be here right now.
But I, in hindsight, I can compare myself. The people I started with are Chris Morris, Steve Cook, and Armando Iannucci.
Yeah.
There's another guy I forgot the name of.
I think I know the guy, but I've not come across him.
They've all done okay.
Fuck, so, even that's enough to get an email from him, probably. Yeah, this is the thing. If in any generation that you emerge as a comedian, there's going to be contemporaries that become...
Yeah.
Huge, and some of them will be younger than you and started after you, and you can't, you know.
I didn't know that you'd been fired by your manager, which comes up in the book. So I didn't know that. So you were being sort of fated as this, as someone who would be doing these big, big tours. You did a tour, as I have as well, I have to say, and Lee and Herring certainly did, where we did big theatres and 90 people came to see the gigs. And I still do plenty of gigs like that, but then for your manager to sort of let you go must have been a difficult thing.
Yeah, what happened was my agent within the management company left to pursue her own things, and I said to the manager, right, well, I need to have a think about what to do because I've been here for I was pretty much the second or third longest running. I'd been there for 8 years. And then she just sent me an email the next day saying, well, it's probably time for you to go anyway. And it's a weird feeling because you do sort of feel like, as I said in the audiobook, you are in quite a kind of codependent relationship with your manager. And if they... We won't dish the dirt or talk about names, but she managed two or three very successful people. And so when you're let go by someone like that, you do sort of think, right, well, I'm done now. And... It's also kind of, again, it's ego. You think, well, who's going to want me? It's like being dumped, basically. It's the same thing as that. And it is sort of, and I was 32, 33, 33, I suppose, at that sort of point. And you do sort of feel like there's no real... But again, I set up a production company. We started touring my own shows, making my own things. Now we work for loads of other people. And none of that would have happened. So again, most bad things that do happen to you, if you have... if you show a bit of kind of fight and come back from it, you do end up weaving better stuff
I think you to become better at the job, I think you need to have the rug pulled from under your feet.
Yes.
And so I'm glad that happened to me, really, but it was very hard to cope with at the time, and it was very hard to work out, you know, where are we going next, what am I doing next. But I think for a management just company to sort of just acknowledge you're a commodity and that they don't need any more of you is that's quite, as a 33-year-old, that's quite a hard thing.
I read the email and then I went on the company's website and they'd already taken my photo off. And I don't like to compare my ex-manager to Stalin, but there's sort of certain points of comparison there. And I think it's something to do with, again, all this is ego, and I wouldn't normally talk about it, but it's like, at the moment, I'm engaged in a long-running film project, and there's a well-known actor attached to it, and every time we have to do a new draft, I have to deliver it incredibly quickly. Like, we've got 48 hours, so I'm like staying up all night and doing this and delivering it. But then every time I hit one of those deadlines, then they take sort of a month. So for example, I was on holiday just before Christmas and I had to do like two or three all-nighters with this other writer who's in Australia, so we're doing it at mad times of the night, and we delivered this script finally, because the whole thing was like, if it needs to be now, otherwise this opportunity will close and the fun, all this. And that was December the, I don't know, 14th, and we're chatting here in late January and absolutely fuck all has happened, except that the famous person at the centre of this project has emailed us all saying, I'll get back to you as soon as I can, but this January is my downtime. And I think that's if I could put my finger on it, that's what I'd like. I've spent a lot of my life being the guy that you can go to get something done really quickly, but you don't have to get back to him really quickly. Or I'm the guy that will ask you to collaborate with me, but you'll never get back to me, and you'll never ask me. So that's what I want, I think. I'd like to be at one level, or however many rungs up it is, where I get to be a bit of a dick to people. Basically.
It'd be nice, you know, and it's as I, you and I both experiences where you work very hard on something and everyone says it's good and everyone says it's the best thing they've ever seen, except the people deciding to put it on the TV.
Yeah.
And it doesn't get on the TV. And that's sort of that heartbreaking thing. So, you know, it would be nice to be the position where you just, whatever you come up with, even if it's Derek, it goes on the TV.
I'm going to distance myself from those comments just in case I... But yeah, that's
you know, but
actually, if we're being completely honest about it, that's probably what I would. That's probably why I'm jealous of people with a bigger reputation. It's not because I want to be doing like the O2 or something like that. It's because I've got such, like you, such a wide range of artistic ambitions that I'd love to have a standing where I'd be taken seriously whatever I propose. And there's only a few people in that category, but nonetheless, we all know who those people are, and most of them don't want to do that much, apart from, you know, so yeah, that I think that's what it is. I feel like I'd be great in a situation where I was already famous, so you would just let me do stuff, rather than I'm still hanging on in there for Mark Watson's Big Clean, which I must say, again, seems a long way away from happening. But again, you've got to be positive, haven't you? We're not say, doing badly.
No, but that's what I mean. I think, you know, you would. I think anyone else would. It's very difficult to look at yourself objectively. I think I've got to the point where I am genuinely happy about where my life is, in my family life and my work life. And I'd like to have two testicles. But apart from
hard to see how you can get back to that.
It is. It's very hard. I'm trying very hard, but nothing's
It's a classic case of, to paraphrase a football phrase, you can't... Well, in football they say you can't win the league before Christmas, but you can lose it. Your situation is like you can't get any more testicles, but you can lose them.
Yeah, exactly.
Basically, like, you're not going back to two, but you could go down to
it
zero.
Is,
so
very much on my mind. Like,
hope not, though. You're doing the right with one, obviously. It doesn't seem to be materially affecting you that much from just following your tweets and stuff. You seem like
no, it's been good. So it's been really good. It's been the best thing that's happened to me so far. But if another one goes, I think that'll be.
You
less
seem like
funny.
One of the happiest unitestical people that I've come across. But I imagine.
But again,
none...
it's sort of about being. But it's again, I think it was one of those things that happens to you, and you. I'm writing a book about it at the moment, so I'm kind of this is
hello.
Right on top of mind. So, but when I first went in, the doctor said it was almost certainly not cancer, and said it was. He told me what it was, and it was going to be fine.
Right.
And I left feeling very happy, but also slightly disappointed that I wouldn't get to write the stand-up show about it.
Yeah, so, you know.
So, careful what you wish for. But also, it is one of that. But the thing that I realised from it was that I want to be alive more than anything else, because I thought I was going to die.
No, I think fair enough. Yeah, and I think, nonetheless, you've got a right to feel aggrieved. In terms of things that can give you a show, you'd rather just... have a cashier challenge you on how much yogurt you bought rather than lose one of your organs or whatever a testicle is.
I think it's about
your career trajectory. Too much yogurt, got a show about that. Weird moustache, got a show about that. Cancer. Was there a point you thought you'd die?
I sort of joke about, I'm cancer free and I've beaten it, it's fine. There's no, you know.
I suppose not. No,
there's no escape from it, because it can always come back. So yeah. But
if it comes back, does it come back in your balls again?
Possibly.
So
hopefully,
I mean,
not, because of I had chemotherapy. But there's 1 in 20 chance of it coming back.
Right.
Which you suddenly go, that's quite. You think, oh, that's good. It was 1 in 4 if I didn't have chemotherapy. 1 in 20 if I did have chemotherapy. And you go, oh, 1 in 20. But still. 1 out of every 20 people who get this, that's probably 1 a day who go through the door of my oncologist, isn't it? So
yeah, so I remember I was quite late onto this, because I remember texting you going, fuck, have you had cancer? Because I didn't, for whatever reason, I didn't notice you talking about it. And then I remember And you were doing tweets going, I've only got one bollock these days. And I thought, this is one of these things Herring's doing. this will be like his thing about Women's Day or something. And I put the pieces together and thought, fuck me, he has got cancer. And that's why I had to tweet you about 3 months late going, yeah. Yeah, no, that must be the realisation that you want to live more than, you know.
Well, it's sort of, but it's again about you, but the death book, because you talk about, you know, not you equally not wanting to die, which none of us want to do for a little while. But I also sort of, I mean, I did a show about death. And
yeah,
I,
you've done that as
and
well.
I think.
Is it called We're All Going to Die?
Yeah,
it?
We're All Going to Die. So, you know, again, it's like I'm a prophet. How do I know? But I feel like dying is actually the thing that makes life worthwhile, right? I think the threat of death, without that there'd be no, I don't think you'd love anyone if without, because it's what really makes you love someone is the fear of losing them, right?
Yeah, I acknowledge this in the audiobook. Yeah. I'm very scared of death, and it is true, the best, I've heard loads of quite bad arguments against that fear, like you won't know anything about it or cause, no, but yeah, as I did write in the book, the one argument you can sort of take on board is, yeah, death makes life meaningful. It's just, I reckon it'd be good if it was, I don't know, like 400 years or something. I accept death eventually, but I don't think it should be that.
I think you'll always want a bit more. That's something
you'll always
that,
want
I mean,
a bit
not
more.
Everyone, but I think most people will always want a bit more. And if it comes to, well, it's now, it's going to happen now, you go, can I have a little bit more? I think there'll always be that.
I would have thought yeah. I've got a thing in my current show is sort of about life expectancy and death. And there's a thing where I calculate someone's life expectancy using an app. And on Friday night, I did it, and you ask a series of questions, and it turned out this woman was going to live to 82, and she went, oh. And not as in that's not enough, as in fuck, that's a bit of a bore, eh? And I'm like, yeah, that's
choose
it.
Choose your words carefully.
Oh yeah, sorry. I forgot you don't know what that's like anymore. Yeah, I reckon most people go thinking, Christ, I would have loved 10 more years or something. If not, then I don't know. I mean, sometimes, I don't know, depends who you are, isn't it? Sometimes you read articles by people that are nearly always The Guardian, long read, and they're dying of cancer or they're dying of something and they're 30. And there's this beautifully nuanced thing saying, even though my life is very short, I'm very grateful to have had it and it's been a great life. And it was really moving, but you always think, yeah, but like if I was dying tomorrow, I wouldn't write a piece like that. I'd just write an article going, fuck! I don't understand how people treat the idea of death with so much equanimity, really.
I went through so much with it, and but very quickly.
Yeah.
So I really... Because also they didn't tell me for ages that most people survive testicular cancer, so I really thought...
It's a good cancer.
Yeah, it is. But the,
not
doctor,
knocking
the
it.
Doctor sounded scared and wouldn't say the word cancer, which I think they're not meant to say.
Mm.
But it just makes you think, fuck, I'm going to like die tomorrow.
If you sense that the doctor's not saying something, yeah, that's definitely worse. Yeah.
And so, but, you know, but I went through it and came out the positive side of it. You know, it's... So, like, it's a year on. There's a part of me that thought I was going to die a year ago. So that's an extra year already. It's different having... I've got small children, and that's the real kicker about it. But you know, it's
It is.
Everything else is can sort of justify it in your mind and get to the point where you think, well, you know, yeah, I could have had another 25 years, but
a lot of it is there's no doubt about it. I didn't think I'd become this person, but certainly with the kids. I mean, my kids are my first one was 30, so you think, yeah, if I should die at 70, then the boy would be 40, but that's not even as old as I am now.
Yeah.
And I'd very much at least like to see him get to this, because I still feel I've got a fair bit. So it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. But there's going to be a point that you think, well, I wouldn't leave my kids now, but there's going to be a point where hopefully you die before your kids, Mark. I really hope that. Fingers crossed. But, you know, you hope one hopes that you will die before your own kids.
You are meant to hope that, yeah. No, you're right, you do.
But there's a point where however far you go, there's going to be a point you're checking out and not seeing the whole thing.
Of course, that's you have to. I've just remembered a bit in the Simpsons, I think it must be, where Homer Simpson's dad is saying, they say that it's the greatest tragedy to bury your own son, but I can see the plus side, or something like that. But you're right. And even if it wasn't your kids, it would be your grandkids, or you have to accept that you're not seeing. You're going to miss some part of the whole story, and I find that very difficult, because your curiosity about what's ahead never really dims, does it?
No.
Like, I the idea that there'll be a film released the day after you die, or there'll still be football the day, or whatever it is that you're into, there's going to be some that you miss and you can't. Yeah, that does my head in. You've got to. I'd just as a football fan, I'd at least like to die. Between June and August. But even then, it still can't be a World Cup year. So I've got to die in the summer of an odd numbered year. I reckon I will die, thinking shit, I'm going to miss whatever it is. Yeah. But that's good in a way, I suppose, because as you say, that lust for stuff is what makes your actual life meaningful. If you died thinking, I'm done, fuck it, I've had enough, then that's not a good outcome either, is it? You know, terrible as it is, you'd rather die still wanting more, I think, than the absolute sweet spot is you're 89 and you've got your grandkids and it's lovely and you live in Lake Como or something and you just nod off to sleep one day and it's all over.
Yeah.
Don't even think about it. But that's not most people. Most people, I'm sure, die thinking, fuck it, and that's just how it is. So yeah.
But also, once you've been under general anaesthetic, I think that's sort of that's what death is, right?
That's not how they taught you through it.
But you'll
feel a sharp scratch, and it will be just like the tomb.
But basically, you don't go anywhere. You know, you're knocked out, and then you wake up.
Yeah.
There's a time there. There's an hour of your life disappears, and you're not aware of it.
It's that,
and
if they don't
wake you up,
longer,
if they don't wake you up, you're in that position.
You're absolutely right, and that's why most people aren't scared of death, because you can visualise it as just a general anaesthetic, but just that you don't come back. And there's nothing. Yeah. But I do find that quite a frightening thought. But again, I don't know. Ricky Gervais interests me. You mentioned it briefly, but he always says he's always tweeting going, you know, death, life is meaningless and death comes and that's great and that's all fine. And I'm like, I don't know. If I was one of the most famous rich people in the world, I wouldn't be doing that. I'd be like, fuck me, how can I get another century of this? I'd be lopping my head off and putting in one of those tanks, I reckon. Some people are just wired to not care about anything beyond your immediate circumstances, but that's not me.
Well, Jeff Bezos is trying to create a kind of way to prolong youth. So he's putting money into the gene technology that will mean we have longer life, but also more of it is as being a young person. So if you had Jeff Bezos's money, would that be where you'd be spending some of it?
Well, I did actually get... I don't think I've spoken about this before, but I did get really interested in cryonics in my early 20s. Not as in I would do it, but I did loads of research into it. I was going to write a book about it, and I looked into... Because, of course, even though it seems like a sort of sci-fi thing and... There are hundreds of people who do, even in this country, who do get themselves frozen in the hope of being reanimated. And I think if that technology... I mean, if I had Bezos money, I probably would put some of it into research into whether we can reverse, I suppose, aging or something. Because I do think that stuff is interesting. But at the end of the day, you've got to accept, really, if you were reanimated 300 years later, you're probably in all sorts of trouble. I reckon, having researched it a bit, I do think the technology could work. Eventually, we'll probably be able to cryopreserve bodies and bring them back to life. But imagine waking up in 200 years and no one everyone have to do it.
Yeah.
You couldn't wake up and be like, oh, I can't wait to see Alan. Oh, yeah, Alan's been dead two centuries. So that's the philosophical problem. I reckon biologically we'll eventually be able to transcend the death of the body, but unless all your mates and your loved ones are doing it, then it's just a more lonely future, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I reckon if I was Bezos, I'd put some money into it. But to be fair, I think I'd put most of my money into initiatives to make life better for people who are currently here now.
Yeah.
I'd try and stop people from sleeping on the street and stuff like that.
Sure.
Probably, yeah. Again, though, Bezos is Bezos. It's
hard to believe, I really like the idea of becoming a billionaire for a few reasons, but one of them is just because what you could, even if you just said, I'm going to spend half a billion, and I'll keep half a billion for me to buy penny chews with and stuff.
Just to have Ferrero Rocher and stuff.
Yeah.
Or like sometimes you don't want the meal deal because one of the items isn't on there. You just get it anyway. That'd be nice, I think.
But to be able to just do stuff with, I mean, I know a lot of them do, but just to be able to, in the position where you could go, I can go to my hometown and just give everyone gold shoes.
It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, yeah.
I do loads of stuff like that, but you know, but also help people.
I do think about it quite a lot. Like Bill Gates has all these charitable foundations and stuff like that. But for every Bill Gates, and Gates gets quite a lot of shit for people, but yeah, there's several hundred people in that category of wealth that just don't. It must be tempting if you've got more money than you could ever need. It must be quite tempting to spend just like $1 billion on, I don't know. There's this, as people here will know, there's a Twitter account that is called something like, "Has Jeff Bezos ended world hunger today?" And every day it just tweets, "Nope." And it can't be that simple, but still, if you've got the button in your hand that you could press, and I know it's not that simple because, of course, if you gave £20 million to some foundation, or if you, whatever you do, there's going to be ways it can be corrupted, or it's not as simple as if I'm a billionaire, I can throw money at this problem and it goes away. But at the same time, it doesn't hurt, does it?
No.
I definitely think if I was a billionaire, I'd spend most of my time, yeah, just giving it to people and see what happens. Because it's not as if, like, what's the point of it all? All you see him doing is just on Twitter with a shirt on that you could pretty much have just got from Zara. and he's by a swimming pool and you think, all right, you're rich. But I mean, if you're that rich, you could have everything you want in the world and you still could, you could palpably improve the lives of tens of thousands of people. It's interesting what the thought process is.
Yeah.
I just don't know because I don't know what it's like being him or Elon Musk and stuff. And I'm sure they're all doing stuff like behind the curtain as well. But yeah, it is weird.
You could just go down the street and give someone here's £10,000. Do what you want with it. You could just do stuff like that and it wouldn't matter because you've made £10,000 in interest in the time it's taking you to walk down the street.
During the conversation, yeah. You made that. Yeah, it must be that you fear that if you set a precedent for doing that, everyone's asking you for it. But still, it'd be worth, like,
I mean, everyone's going to ask it. I'll bloody ask him for 10 grand.
I imagine so.
Oh, shit, I should have asked for more. It's got loads.
If Bezos walked in here, we'd all make a case. I reckon, yeah. Yeah, I can only think that at a certain level of wealth, you become so paranoid that everyone wants something from you that you don't even enter into these conversations. But, like, I think I would just give my old school loads of money. Or just, there's loads of stuff.
Wouldn't it be cool just to go to, I'd go to Cheddar and say, I'm going to pay everyone's county council tax for the next 15 years. And it'll probably be millions of pounds, but I've got £1 billion. A million's nothing.
Yeah, there was once a time, I'm not saying this to look like a good guy because this is pretty minor, but there was once a time I got unexpected 200 quid from some job or something that I'd forgotten I'd done the job and I got paid. And I just went on Twitter and just gave a tenner each to loads of different, like, just give, because every day on Twitter, on the internet, you see dozens of worthwhile causes.
Yeah.
So I just anonymously put a tenner in loads of these accounts. And it felt really good. And I didn't need the £200 because I hadn't expected that I had it. It was like free money. But yeah, if you're Bezos, that'd be you putting £1 million into it. Like, imagine just being Bezos and going around the Just Givings and someone's trying to, or someone's just trying to crowdsource for their knitting project and they stick a fucking £1 billion in there. It would be pretty tempting. But even imagine seeing someone asking for, they need 300 grand to get this very unusual surgery in California. If you knew you could do that, I don't know, I reckon you'd do it. George Michael did it, didn't he?
Yeah.
He just anonymously did all this stuff. I reckon, again, there's no point in criticising the deeds of people like Elon Musk because I don't know anything about the guy. But I reckon if you had enough money that it was unrealistic you could ever run out of money, you could just spend a day on the internet and, like, finding 100 things that you could give a life-changing amount to and it still wouldn't impact on you at all.
Yeah.
If you're in the position where your income, as you say, grows exponentially or whatever the phrase is every day, yeah, it must be tempting to do that.
But like, it's the same thing as comedians looking at other comedians. If they're looking at other billionaires and going, well, he's got 100 billion. If I give away 1 billion, I won't be the most rich man in the world.
Yeah, I'll have slid down the rich list. Yeah, I suppose. It's interesting. It's a weird thing.
And we could all do it to some extent. Like you say, we could all do it to some extent. I could go and give £200 to loads of different Just Giving things. I'm not going to fucking do it.
Yeah. I only did it because I got an unexpected £200.
So it's only just that's the thing, isn't it? Just you get richer, and we're both richer than we probably thought we would be 25 years ago. And
yeah, I could do that once a month, probably, and I wouldn't, but I don't do it. So that's the thing. Yeah. Exactly. So it's presumably it's the same thing. If you're Bezos, you could give £1 billion away, but you just don't, because to you £1 billion is like a grand or something. Yeah. So I don't know.
It's a grand, it's a lot of money.
But it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Except you and I both know what it's like to pay a mortgage and pay for stuff for kids and stuff. And there must be a point of super wealth where you could never be worried about. Bezos isn't at a cash point thinking, I hope this gets approved. Bezos is not scanning his card and thinking, so there must be a point of wealth where you are absolutely disengaged from the worry of whether you have enough money for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And then, like, you've got to be thinking, you get through the bits where you're like, I'm just going to buy hungry hippos and make them have it always my face. And that's my first port of call, I think. Sure.
But you could just do pranks and stuff with them. I mean, you could just do stupid things with the money. You'd have so much money, you could do funny things, you could do things that are wasteful, you could do things that were generous to the wrong people.
you could do anything, you could just pay everyone in Chile to stand on one leg for a bit.
Yeah.
You probably wouldn't, but
you could do it.
I suppose you're leaving it to your kids, you're leaving it to, who knows what people are doing with their money, but I do think there's a point of wealth where you should be doing more pranks with it, definitely.
More pranks. Yeah. More pranks. I love that. So, 8 Deaths is, if you with Audible, you get, that's just free with Audible. Is that the only way to get it, or can you buy it as well?
I'm hoping it might become an actual book, like a print book. Yeah. You can buy it, but nearly everyone gets it by just, I don't really know how Audible works, but you just basically get it, yeah.
you can join Audible for free, and then you could download it.
So for the point of view of monetizing it, I'm up against it.
Yeah.
Because there's absolutely no reason for anyone to pay money for it.
I hope they paid you in advance for it. But it I was did, also.
To be fair, yeah. Not loads, but enough that I can. Yeah.
But you've also had a new novel, your 7th novel, I'm guessing, unless there's been one since, which I was listening to on the way here, Contacts, which is a great idea.
Yeah, that's a while ago now. So, there's another novel coming, hopefully. Yeah, but, okay.
It's a great idea for. I mean, it's about death again.
Yeah. Carry on.
But it's a nice idea.
Sort of is, yeah.
So what? So tell us what the idea for what the.
Well, it's about a guy who of our not ours, my sort of age, early 40s, who sends no offense, of course, but
it is factual.
You're a survivor. writes a text to his whole phone book. Announcing that he's going to kill himself, and the book charts the attempts of all of his loved ones to talk him down, but he's on a train, the sleeper train, in fact, from London to Edinburgh. And in fact, a bit of trivia, I went on the sleeper train to Edinburgh the night that the book is set, so March 8th, which I think it is... It's pretty close to International Women's Day.
Yes.
Because I seem to remember that night, I stayed up all night taking notes on what the train was like and stuff, and I was looking at you doing your stuff on Twitter. Is it March the 9th? Or
March the 8th.
March the 8th. So
I don't know. I'm not an expert on International Women's Day.
I know, of course you are.
I know, I can tell you.
You've never claimed to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's set on the night that Richard does his thing. And yes, the book basically... So it's about... It's the action of the book is the guy's ex-partner... and sister and mum and all these people trying to text him and talk him down from this position. And so it's sort of about how we all connect kind of virtually in this day and age, and how you've always got connections with people that you don't realise, and that sort of thing. In a way, the idea is slightly out of date already, because it was inspired by years ago when you had a Nokia phone, you could send a text to your whole... And you actually still see it. You still get a text at Christmas that says, Happy Christmas, you've made my year so much better, blah, blah, blah. And then when you look at it, it has gone to 175 people. But years ago, I thought, what would happen if you sent a text as dramatic as that to your entire phone? But what would... And so the book is sort of about the chaos that is unleashed when someone does this, but it's also kind of about how much we owe, how much responsibility we owe to each other, I suppose. Yeah.
No, it's a really neat concept. It reminds me a little bit of a book I didn't like. And I like your book.
I'm always looking for those sort of testimonies. Yeah.
Have you read The Midnight Library by
Matt Haig?
Matt Haig, yeah.
Yeah, I have, yeah. Because another way that I make myself feel better about myself is just reading authors who are doing the same sort of thing as me, but they've got 1,000 times as many readers. Yeah.
It's very much like it's sort of in the same ballpark as I've.
Yes, that's about a suicidal person who like
your idea and my idea, one of my ideas as well. So that's part of the reason I don't like the Midnight Library because it's about multiple universes and an infinite amount of stuff can happen.
Yes,
but every time she could go to every time she goes somewhere, it's not as good as the life she's got at the moment. But she could go to the versions of it where it's better than the life. And she never really goes. She goes to Australia.
Huge spoilers here, by the way.
Goes to Australia and her friend dies in Australia. But in an infinite number of timelines, her friend doesn't die in Australia. So don't go to the one where your friend dies.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Do you want to tell Matt Haig or me?
Yeah, I'm going to give her a... And I'm very pernickety about alternate universes and timelines and stuff. Luckily, yours isn't about time travel, no, so you're okay. It's all happening in a day, so I don't have a problem.
Matt Haig's book is about a person who's sort of suicidal, and they get to a place where they can live out an infinite number of other universes and lifespan that they could have lived in. Yeah. Which is a challenge. Yeah, my one is just about a guy who has had enough, and it's about people trying to convince him that his life is still worth it, but none of them can get hold of him on the phone because he's on a sleeper train. He's put his phone on airplane mode, so most of the book takes place through texts and fruitless texts and stuff like that. Yeah, I think it's because, the book's about how there's a general assumption that social media and phones and all of these things are bad for us and have driven us further apart because we don't spend enough time having real relationships. But this book is about how actually, if you've got a phone in your pocket with everyone's number that you've ever met, you have a sort of daily possibility to enrich in the end those people's lives. And I think I'm not really a tech person, but I think it's obvious that more tech contact with everybody means more chance to be sort of together. We just don't necessarily exploit that. Yeah. So the book is about in a world where we're all potentially quite lonely, can you use phones and the internet and stuff to actually become less lonely, which I don't think I've seen that written, but that's why I wrote it. Most things I've seen, stuff like Black Mirror, which is amazing, by the way, but most stuff you see about the way that tech is accelerating, the basic premise is this is bad. And I think it's good. I think it's good we've all got phones and WhatsApp and even Twitter. All these things that people routinely say are all these things drive people mad. They're stupid. Like, they're only as good or bad as we are. The Twitter's the most amazing tool in the world. It connects everyone that exists with everyone else, and it's just most of the time we just use it for absolute bullshit.
Yeah.
We just use it to put a picture up of Michael Fabricant, for example, and but we've turned his hair into a cottage pie, and or someone tweets a thing saying, I didn't really like Home Alone 2. And then 58 people text them going, you should die then. But because unfortunately, the way we use the tool of infinite exchange of ideas is basically to fight one another. But I think the principle of Twitter and even Facebook and all these things is absolutely amazing. You can potentially contact and share stuff with anyone in the world. I don't think we should completely lose sight of that, basically.
You would think, and I'm sure they did think when the internet began, that it would be like an amazing positive thing where an idea could... I mean, it should be revolutionary in the sense that everyone in the world could contact everyone in the world, which means everyone in the world could sort of rise up simultaneously and go, this world isn't right, we should change it like this. You know,
absolutely.
That exchange of ideas, and maybe that will happen.
Maybe it will, but this is the thing. If I'd been told when I was 16, 17 that you'd have... Yeah, a phone, and not just a phone, but a potential link on 3 or 4 different channels to everyone you've ever met, everyone you'd like or know, but also a theoretical contact with anyone in the world, I think we must be living in a much better world then. And the fact that we're not is a sort of indictment of how we use it, I think. Of course it's inevitable. Of course there's always going to be loads of dicks. But I do think that people are always talking about... And it was also true that Twitter is quite poorly policed by Twitter. Lots of shit goes down. Like, all of these platforms could be better monitored. But it's not a bad thing that Twitter or Facebook exist. It's just that we're not... We could be using them to change each other's lives, and we just don't do that much, I think.
Yeah.
It's so easy to say, oh, now we've all got phones, we don't properly connect. But obviously, bollocks. These days you can talk to... If your mate is in Brazil, you can chat to them, and you used to have to write them a letter. So that's got to be better. But we haven't got better at connecting with other humans in proportion with the way the text got better. I think that's all it is.
Well, I think that's true. And I remember touring before social media and how, you know, having a bad tour before social media. And really, I mean, yeah, there was phones, you could text people, but you were generally sat in a bar on your own feeling sad. And now there's social media, you can sit in a bar and chat to people about something else that isn't to do with you feeling good or bad about your gig as well. So.
Yeah, and if you were hoping to boost your sales in that area, you could... I mean, now you can at least tweet going, right, no one came tonight in Swindon, please come tomorrow. And you'll get some people in the 90s, you're just writing a letter to everyone on your mailing list saying, it's unlikely, but if you can find your way to Wiltshire tomorrow. I think with most technology, I know that there's exceptions like the nuclear bomb, but with most tech, it's futile to say we should never have invented this. You should say, now we have invented this, what could we do with it that's positive, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're right at the beginning. You know, if it's an age, if there's an internet age or a computer age, we're right at the beginning of it. And so, like, in historical terms, we're like, it's day one, really.
Yeah, we're the cavemen. Yeah, yeah. In 200 years, people will be shit hot on WhatsApp. They really well. It'll
be amazing.
Even your mum will be good at it.
And she'll still be alive with her head in a tank.
Or she'll have uploaded all her data onto...
Elon Musk is trying to get us to be able to download our memories into... and put them into other people and stuff, I think.
Yeah, my son was telling me, who's 11, was telling me about this today. Classic case of a kid talking at you and you're like, eat this banana, you haven't eaten anything. He's like, yeah, did you know Elon Musk is getting a chip in his brain? And you're like, that's interesting, but you must eat the banana. But Musk's thing is, the chip goes in and then they can put
They can download the memories. I think you put the memories. I mean, it's Total Recall, isn't it? It's going to be good. I can't remember, and nothing bad happens in Total Recall. I think it's all good.
No, any film where you see where some of this happens, it always ends well. Yeah,
But no, it's true about literature and technology. Is always it's the worst thing. It's the thing that will go wrong actually, technology is massively, and all the and vaccines and medicine has improved the world in this incredible way. Yeah, it's human nature.
Yeah.
To look at what could go wrong and be scared of change and stuff.
But yeah, most technology is good news. Basically, yeah. It's just we can always see. But the reason it always goes wrong is because we always do stupid stuff with it. Yeah.
But we do stupid stuff with everything.
Yeah, we'll do stupid stuff anyway.
You could hit someone with a book.
I mean, yeah. Is that how this ends?
Yeah. So that's Contacts, which you beautifully read in audiobook yourself.
I did actually read it. Yeah.
Yeah, it was good. I'm going to listen to the rest of it. Well, not the rest of it in the car or journey home, but the next hour in the car journey home.
That's nice.
I'm a couple of hours into it. It's very good.
I enjoy reading it. It's quite fun reading your own book, isn't it?
So, and I might try. I keep saying this and then not doing it, but I feel you should do the audiobook before you hand in the final book.
Right.
Because every time you read it, you go, oh, that bit was shit.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
And you correct it, and it's too late to correct the book.
I had a lot of moments reading the audiobook where I would get to a paragraph and like read a specific word and think, what? That's shit.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're listening to it and you hear the author say, and he carried it all the way to, that's shit, then you do lose faith in it a little bit. Yeah.
Maybe the alternative, you could just read your own book to yourself before, but you don't do that. You don't read your book out. But being forced to read your book out is quite a good thing to do.
There are authors who apparently do that, who if there's dialogue in the novel, they actually sit in their house and read it. Plenty of authors will say, read your whole novel out to yourself, out loud, before you... But I mean, that's a weird thing to do, I think you've got... For a start, no one else can live in the house with you. But even if they don't, imagine that.
Yeah. At least tape it so it can be the audiobook.
Yeah.
Use your time. Just do the audiobook yourself. Then you know. Anyway, that's I'm very much enjoying that. I think the eight deaths is it's lovely because it's self-deprecating, but it's honest and it's you know, it takes you through. I mean, I love the thing about going on your book event all full of hope and your first book event and thinking lots of people are going to come when they. Nobody comes to those things.
Well, four people, yeah. But it was in Ayr in the west of Scotland, and it took me 8 hours to get there.
It's absolutely insane that they sent you to Ayr.
It was really,
absolutely insane to send a new author to Ayr. They should have known.
But again, it's one of those things, you do a lot of this in your career where someone says, do you want to do this gig, which sounds awful, and won't pay, and you think, yeah, but they must know what they're doing, and then,
yeah.
A good, not just in comedy or entertainment, a good lesson is, I think, in life, if someone encourages you to do something, and it's at, and your gut feeling is like, oh no, I don't think so. Don't trust the person. Go with your gut feeling. I've done so many terrible things in my career because I thought, oh, I don't know, that sounds terrible. And someone said, honestly, this will be great. And then when it is terrible, you think, well, that's a sort of bittersweet victory.
But and you're on tour with this Can't Be It.
Yes, and that tour is kind of almost infinite because. Okay. There were so many shows rescheduled for it goes through to at least October.
Okay, great.
I mean, you sort of can't. If you've got any interest in watching it, you wouldn't be able to miss it. If you Google me, you'll see such an intimidating list of shows. It would be. You'd have to make a proper effort to. Even if you don't want to come to it, I will one day be in your room. Like, that's how many tour shows there are.
Good. Well, everyone must go and see that. And free book on Audible. And
you can pay for it, but you probably don't need to.
Join Audible. Yeah. You get the free book for free. Download Contacts for free. Then leave Audible. And then Mark Watson will get no money and you'll have all of his stuff.
Rinse all my career and then leave again, yeah. And I don't even mind. I like people reading it,
Oh, damn, I should have made them read my books. look, it's been terrific to have you back on the podcast. And thank you for doing one in lockdown as well. That was. You forgot, you shut the computer before it had loaded up, though.
Yeah.
So that's why the sound quality isn't very good on that one.
I think both of us were absolutely hammered. I think we were. You were drinking whiskey throughout, and that encouraged me to drink wine throughout. Yeah. And
when I asked you to do this, I'd forgotten that you'd done one on the. I thought I'll ask Martin. I thought, did he do one of the? I seem to remember he did one of the remote ones. No,
I think I've done one and a half before this. Yeah.
But yeah, I remember the one you did in the Leicester Square Theatre. Terrific, ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for Mark Watson.
Thank you very much.
Gene, comedy Gene. Thank you very much for coming. See you at Leicester Square Theatre, if you like. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, improvisation, my dear Mark Watson. Thank you to Scant Regard for providing some music for these credits and doing nothing else the whole time they were here. What rude men. I've been indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. He's shining lights in my face now to try and put me off. Thank you to Chris Evans, not that one, for all his work at GoFaster Stripe and Sky Potato. I'm indebted to George Lingford, who's recording the sound for these broadcasts. He is extremely good, and people who say he's incompetent should back off. Ridiculous. Thank you to everyone at the Phoenix for having us. It's been lovely to be back at this beautiful venue. I'm sure we'll be back again. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz on GoFasterStripe.com production. We will see you soon at the Leicester Square Theatre. Go to richardherring.com/gigs for more information. You might be able to get to see us at the Leicester Comedy Festival. Who knows? Thanks for listening. Now go away.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It will make me feel sad.